Welcome to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore the people, stories, and events in our seven-county listening area in central Iowa. I am Susan Franzen, one of your hosts for today, together with my co-host, Paul Wearson. Hi, Paul. And have you recovered from Scandinavian days?
Yes, and we had a wonderful time up there, and the weather was wonderful. We were very fortunate, and I understand we're going to have wonderful weather again this weekend.
Yes, and I'm sure the people preparing for Fireman's Day in Cambridge are happy. We'll hear from them at the end of the show. Also, those driving down to the Ankeny Community Theater for the middle of yesterday will have a pleasant evening. But much of our program today is going to be about how the weather's changing is causing an issue with climate, which is weather's cousin. Not the same thing at all. Specifically about some of the responses of Iowa farmers to the international news of the U.S. withdrawing from the Paris Climate Agreement.
Well, now, who have you found to do that?
Well, first, we'll hear from two outstanding organic farmers about the choices they make on their farms relating to the expected effects of climate change. Then we'll hear from Gene Tockley, professor of agricultural meteorology at Iowa State University, about his take on how Iowa will be affected by this striking reversal of U.S. climate policy. First, we'll hear from Tom Franzen.
Well, Tom Franzen, is he related to you, Susan?
No, but I'd be proud if he was. He's been recognized as an outstanding farmer since the Isaac Walton League honored him as Outstanding Soil Conservationist in 1993. More recently, he and his wife Irene were selected as Farmers of the Year by MOSES, Midwest Organic and Sustainable Service, in 2009. And then they were master researchers chosen by Practical Farmers of Iowa in 2013, and they received the prestigious Spencer Award from the Leopold Center in 2015. We have Tom on the phone now to tell us about how he and Irene manage their diversified farm. Since you have a farm background, Paul, I know you'd like to meet them.
Well, that's good. Hello, Tom. I hope you're with us.
Oh, yes.
I'm glad you could be with us today. I appreciate your finding the time because I understand it's a very busy morning for you there.
Yeah, June is always a busy morning. Yeah, but it's a pretty morning here, but yeah.
Yeah, it's nice, sort of fresh air today. I live on a farm myself just south of Story City, and the cats were shivering this morning. It was just a little bit chilly, my farm cats.
Yep.
So tell us how you became a farmer.
Well, I live where I was born, and I did go to engineering school for a year, bought my parents' farm here. My wife and I have been here since we got married in 1976, and we have three grown children and a son that lives nearby that's involved in our farming operation, he and his partner. So I farmed for 43 years, and about half of that with chemicals, and concentrated livestock, and then we converted the entire farm to certified organic in the late 1990s. So today we have, and we've had through all those organic years, a beef cow herd. We run about 60 mother cows, and we have a brood sow herd. We run about 40 brood sows. We feed out all of the raised livestock to slaughter and market them to Organic Valley Co-op. We raise organic corn, organic soybeans, organic small grains, hay and pasture, and we do sell some food-grade organic soybeans. But the most of our farm is organic cattle and hogs, most of our income.
Now, what type of terrain do you have there?
We live in the Iowan surface, if you're familiar with Iowa's topography, of northern Chickasaw County. It was all a tall, wet prairie in 1860, and it's a radically altered ecosystem to this day, I can promise you that much.
Well, I happen to live on our family farm just south of Story City, Iowa, and my dad began farming there in 1930 with horses, and after my career in Des Moines, I moved back to the farm because Dad and I had beautified the place. We planted a lot of trees, and we painted all the buildings. In fact, my buildings are going to be 100 years old in the year 2019.
Yeah, our barn here dates to 1890, and we work at preservation. Our barn is now only completely used, but it actually has most of the appearance of an 1890 English-style barn. And the same thing with our house here. It's been updated many times, but our house has the appearance of the time it was built from 1890 to 1900.
Oh, yeah, I can identify exactly with where you live and what you do and the farm and the way it looks. My barn and crib are... Each of them are 40 feet high. They're beautiful things. Now, you were not always an organic farmer, were you?
No. The transition to organic began in the 1990s, and it was driven largely by quality of life decisions. So we had to find a path that you could take what today is considered a very small farm and make it economically and ecologically viable. And so the organic path was the one we have chosen, and it's been a very good path for us.
Well, you know, when I was growing up, you could raise a family on 160 acres, you know, and that's what my dad did with patches of alfalfa and beans and corn and oats in a real diversified situation. Yeah. And that's what I grew up with and I'm familiar with, and I know that now most farmers farm the land they own, plus they rent many acres to have a very large production facility
for corn. We own 320 acres, but we have a full-time herdsperson that works for us, and we pay a good share of income tax. So now, the chips fall where they may, but we're always paying income taxes, and I think that shows that, you know, we basically have a profitable operation here. But it's very much value-added in about every aspect.
Well, now, you might let us, the folks in our audience, know exactly what it is to be an organic farmer.
Well, we meet the standards defined by the National Organic Program, which is part of, it's a U.S. Department of Agriculture supervised program. So those standards are written by a board, and we comply with them. And I'd say one way to look at it, and I don't mean to be condemning by this, but most farmers farm with chemistry and we farm with biology, and there's really a lot of truth in that, and it actually leads us to a discussion of the climate that we deal with. Because biology takes biological processes, and they're very, very weather-sensitive.
Wow. Well, now, you're involved in agricultural research, too, Tom.
Yeah.
Is that correct? To explain that a
little. Yeah, we have been involved with replicated on-farm research ever since the very origin of the Practical Farmers of Iowa. In those early days, all of our research was focused on row crops. In the past 6 years, we've had a fairly intense focus on organic hogs, organic grow finish hogs, and that research continues to this very day, and there's some very interesting things going on there with just the on-farm research. But
now, describe how the hogs live on your farm.
Well, they have to live under the National Organic Program standards, so there are no slat floors. They have to have outdoor access. There are no antibiotics. They have to have 100% organic feed. We have to maintain their identity all the way to slaughter. We were sorting and shipping hogs earlier this morning. So we have to comply with the organic program.
Well, you know, when I was growing up, all of our animals were out under the sky, and we had cattle and hogs and sheep, and that was just what I accepted as the natural, and now things have changed a great deal for a lot of farmers in Iowa and throughout the Midwest. Now, we're talking now about climate change and some of the extreme weather situations. How's that impacted you?
Well, you know, back what I said earlier, that we farm with biology instead of chemistry, I can argue farming with chemistry is fairly reliable, as most of agriculture is done. Farming with biology, you deal with what the situations you have, because we have to solve our problems with natural processes. But when I go back and I'll talk about some of the last 5 years, the problems we faced, we had a severe drought in 20 and 12. And I can remember all the droughts in the early years, 1988, and I may go back to all the early years. I remember most of those, and then my dad talking about the 30s. But in none of those years did it get so dry that it killed our hay crop. In 20 and 12, our new seeding was dead in the middle of August, and we had to try to replant it, and the replanting failed. And with the beef cow herd, that's a serious issue. which really caused us an ongoing problem with crop rotation for years that was originated with the 20 and 12 drought. Now, then on Monday Morgan got over with, and what happened in 20 and 13, northern Iowa and southern Minnesota had millions of acres that were prevented planted, because in 20 and 13, we went from extremely dry 2012 to an unbelievably wet 2013. So we got most of our crops in 2013, but we had ground that, even spite of all the drainage that we have, was impossible to farm in 20 and 13. So that was another loop. 2014, we had an extremely difficult spring. We went from too wet to too dry to too wet to too dry and froze on the 13th of September. Thank God for federal crop insurance in the year of 2014. But so, okay, 15 may have been somewhat normal. I forget the crises from that one. But 2016 was another interesting year. A fairly decent spring and early summer, so I had the crops in good shape right through the end of June. But in July, August, and September of 2016, our farm caught 40 inches of rain, 40 inches. That's more than annual precipitation should be for the whole 12 months. In fact, a lot more.
Yes.
We had so many flash floods last summer, I just lost count. It turned into a blur. And two nights last summer, I was up all night scared to death whether my stock cows would be going to be alive at dawn. Experience I've never had. So I don't think we lost any livestock. When you got 60 cows and calves, you're never sure if a calf didn't disappear in there. But it was a truly frightening experience to get that much rain. And we had in our county two deaths caused directly by flooding. One person swept off the road. One person's vehicle went off the road because of soft shoulder and killed that person. Both young, not young people, well, one very young person going to work, one older man going to work, and were killed in flood events. So that was 2016. All right, well, okay. Now we're going to 2017. So I grow small grains, corn, soybeans, but we do have a new crop this year we're going to show in a few weeks. But at any rate, so I planted the small grains, oats, and not a lot of acres of it, on the 13th of April. On the morning of the 15th of April, we get 3 inches of rain in 1 hour and a blinding, pounding, beating, almost crossways high winds, and the water flooded across the roads, tore the rock off the roads, tore a culvert out of a county ditch by us, did an unimaginable amount of soil erosion. The farmers I know of, I know my entire life, said that's the worst soil erosion in the spring of 2017 they have ever seen, they think, ever. Of course, the ground was soft and loose, and it's April, you know, and we're not supposed to get 3 inches of rain in 1 hour. But we got it. Okay. All right. In our oats, it probably cut the crop in half. That oats is just going to be a poor crop. It pounded the ground. The stand is poor. The weeds are there. It's just off to a bad start, and I can't change that. So, okay, weather goes by a few weeks, you know, now it's time to plant corn, and I wait. I plant corn in beautiful conditions on the 13th and 15th of May, and on the 17th we get a very, very sharp cold front in here with very cold rain, and the cold water goes in and shocks the seed, and half my corn had to get tore up and replanted because the cold water entered the seed instead of the warm water from the soil. That's called seed shock. Okay, a deal with that, all right, so that got done. And now, after that went on, it quit raining completely. And so now we sit here on powder dry surface conditions that we can't plant our soybeans because we have no moisture to plant the seed into. Well, I could get the planter out in the field, but it doesn't do me any good because we're too dry to plant into now. So floods and droughts and extreme temperature changes, and that's just in the last 6 weeks.
Wow. You know, that's amazing.
But wow, yeah, I give you something normal once.
Yeah, you know, I keep rain records at my farm. I've got 12 years of rain records. And the average over that time is exactly 24.8 inches of rain per year with varieties. Well, my variance has been from 19 inches in a season to 42 inches. And I only measure from April 1 to September 30.
Yeah, the growing season. Yeah.
Yeah. So that's the pattern. Now, last year, we had that same rainy spring, And then when I look back at June last year, it ceased to rain. I only had 2 inches of rain in all of June here in central Iowa. And so these things happen. Now, the folks who deny climate change would say change has always been there and extreme weather has always been there. But is that true?
Well, I love to study Earth history, and it's been one of my passions. But to deny the effect of climate change shows that you don't know anything about Earth history, because we have had many, many mass extinctions in the past driven by sudden, abrupt climate change. The mechanisms that govern our climate in our Earth are really, really complicated, but they're very interrelated. But believe me, we can switch, and we can see really severe consequences of it. A person told me a long time ago that if you study things and you start to appreciate them, you'll have a very humble attitude. And I think that humility by some of our leaders is sorely lacking.
So it's a very important issue, and although there's a lot of discussion about it, to those who've studied the issue, it seems apparent that climate change is accelerating, and indeed that human activity has been involved in that acceleration. So you have to accept that fundamental view of things to act on it, thinking that we can alter some of this by our own behavior, right, Tom?
Yes. Agriculture in the face of the earth is really, really, really new. It's only about 7,000, maybe 8,000 years old. So over the eons of time, agriculture is even a little bitty flicker, how small it is. So our perception of human beings is always limited by our ability to think about today and tomorrow. And we have to step back and take a look at the long-term consequences. And with our intense agriculture and world population, it's a very precarious situation. I call it probably the most loaded deck I've ever seen.
Yes, and I think that the hard thing is to get people to understand and believe that who aren't familiar with some of the history and some of the trends over the long period.
I totally agree. It does you a lot of good to study, and there are wonderful programs and DVDs that are available to guide you through at a lay level of how the Earth processes work. But they're very, very powerful, and they have been known to swing radically back and forth. People say, well, climate change means they're just going to warm up. Well, maybe might warm up and hit a tripping mechanism, and we go from extremely warm to extremely cold. That has definitely happened in the past.
Well, Tom Franson, thank you very much for your input today. It's been a real revelation to hear about your actual experiences and how they fit into what we know and are learning about climate change. Good luck with the hogs today, and have a good time, and may the weather be your friend.
Well, that would be very nice. We'll pray for some rain up here.
Very good. Thanks, Tom.
Real good.
This is KHOI Community Radio, and co-host Paul Wearson has been talking with Tom Franson, an award-winning organic farmer who has a great concern with the effects of climate change on his farm. The big national news last week was in President Trump's announcement that the U.S. would pull out of the 2015 Paris Climate Accord. In order to find out how this would affect Iowa, especially Iowa agriculture, I went to Agronomy Hall to ask how Iowans can learn about the effects of President Trump's decision to withdraw from the Paris Climate Accord. I had read that 10 governors and mayors of 211 cities signed this pledge. We are increasing investments in renewable energy and energy efficiency. We will buy and create more demand for electric cars and trucks. We will increase our efforts to cut greenhouse gas emissions, create clean energy economy, and stand for environmental justice. And if the president wants to break the promises he made to our allies enshrined in the historic Paris Agreement, we'll build and strengthen relationships around the world to protect the planet from devastating climate risks. The world cannot wait, and neither will we. Iowa's not among the states that signed the pledge, but the mayors of Des Moines and Dubuque were among the 211 mayors who signed. I wanted to hear the Iowa response from Eugene Tackley, who is both a professor of atmospheric science in the College of Liberal Arts and a professor of agricultural meteorology in the College of Agriculture. And here's what he had to say.
The Paris Agreement does not in itself mean that we will have immediate and major changes in policy across the U.S. and in Iowa. There will be certain policy changes that have already been implemented, but the major effect of this failure to sign is really an abdication of leadership. It means that rest of the world, except for some three countries, have come together to address this issue. And the U.S. now has chosen, through its leadership, has chosen to step aside from that and not follow the agreement that's been signed in Paris. So what that means is that those nations that have signed are going to look to each other to establish policies, to establish trade arrangements, to enhance jobs and so on. And the U.S., without action such as is being taken by cities and states and the private sector, would be left out. And recognizing this and the importance of being a part of this movement, whether or not we're part of the agreement, but we're part of this movement, means that state governments and cities see the need to sign on or to do their part. And so they've stepped up very boldly and are taking measures to, when possible, interact directly with foreign governments and foreign institutions to promote climate-smart policies.
What does this mean for Iowa, particularly for Iowa agriculture?
I think that the jury's out on that, how that's going to all play out. Agriculture trade, of course, is part of a larger trade activity, and so trade policies could change in response to countries' desires to trade more actively within those nations that have signed the agreement. So it could be not necessarily that our trade is with agriculture is directly affected by this, but perhaps indirectly through the whole trade agreements that are being set up. Iowa products, of course, have been well received around the world. We are one of the major exporters of agricultural products. But there may be political things that get in the way of maintaining that sort of stature in the international trade world. So I think it's yet to be seen how other nations respond and whether they will really want to maintain these agreements or whether they just decide to go with other nations, Argentina, Brazil, or other major producers of commodities that normally the U.S. has dominated.
The other concern for Iowa farmers is how climate change is affecting their agriculture and how they may operate as farmers to mitigate climate change.
Yes, and farmers, most Iowa farmers agree that the climate is changing and that they are adapting to it. It's costing them money to adapt to it. The more intense rainfall events that we have means that they've been putting in more subsurface drainage tile. The more humidity means that they are having more costs to dry the grain in the fall, particularly corn, in order for it to have appropriate shelf life to extend until they want to sell it in the following summer or fall. And they're buying larger machinery so that they can get the crop planted in these narrow windows between major rain events. And so in a number of ways, they're spending more money. They are seeing more pests and pathogens because of the more humid weather and the more favorable conditions for fungus and mold and those kinds of challenges. Most farmers are reluctant to link this to human activities, however. But if you connect the dots, it becomes pretty clear that it is the increase in greenhouse gases, the warming of the Gulf of Mexico, which there has more evaporation now than it did 40 years ago. There is a strengthening of the winds that bring that humid air up into Iowa, and there's been an increase in the heavy storm events that we get in the spring and early summer, and these are all clearly linked to the increase in greenhouse gases. So it's very clear from a scientific perspective what's causing these changes to Iowa farmers, and they are in fact paying more to accommodate or to adapt to these changes.
Well, you're talking about the larger model of farming. There is something that the USDA has put out called Climate Smart Agriculture. And could you talk a little about that and what kind of changes in agriculture this would entail?
Climate Smart Agriculture has a variety of practices that are being promoted to improve agriculture's resilience to climate variation and climate change. We also have seen, in addition to climate change, climate trends, we're seeing more swings of climate, if you like, toward more extremes of dry conditions and flooding conditions. So practices that will make the landscape more resilient are being strongly promoted by USDA. Some examples are the use of cover crops, and we're seeing this more in Iowa. A lot of farmers are adopting this. It means planting crops that are not intended for harvest but are primarily intended to protect the landscape in the periods between major crops. So they might put in a seed in a type of grass or even radishes in these periods between crops, probably planted in the late fall or very early spring, that will protect the soil during these heavy rain events. They also have the added benefit that they add carbon to the soil, and this is a good thing. We have, through our tillage practices, have lost about half the carbon from our agricultural soils in Iowa in the last 150 years. And the result of that is that the soils cannot hold as much water as they previously did, and they don't hold nutrients as well. And these are both negative for agriculture. So building back that soil carbon through the use of cover crops, through minimum tillage, through leaving more residue on the landscape, those are ways that farmers can improve that condition and to some measure suppress the negative effects of these extreme rainfall events. That's just one example. USDA has provided a variety of examples of what types of crops should be used, cover crops should be used, depending upon your situation and your soils. There are other practices like extending the use of grassed waterways, because in these extreme rainfall events, we see water running off hill slopes and into gullies and then down toward rivers and streams. And it's these temporary streams that are established during rain events that lead to very high levels of soil erosion. And so by putting what we call grassed waterways or planting perennial grasses in these otherwise gullied areas helps to hold the soil in place during these extreme events that occur. Certainly there are examples in Iowa as well where farmers have planted strips along streams that consist of strips of shrubs, native deep-rooting grasses, and also trees that have multiple benefits. They, in addition to protecting the waterway from nutrients and heavy rainfall and rapid flooding, they are hold the soil in place and allow for wildlife, more wildlife flourishing. They add biodiversity to the landscape. They add habitat for pollinators, and so there are many benefits of this.
Agricultural meteorology must have something to do with predicting climate. Is that a problem? Is there any way that you can predict these extreme events?
Yes, one of the activities that I and my colleagues here have been engaged in for over 20 years is the simulation of future climates that we will likely experience if we continue this path of increased greenhouse gas emissions, heat trapping gas emissions. So my first paper on this on simulating the climate of Iowa was published in 1992. So 25 years ago, we had published a paper on this, and that paper suggested that the growing season would be longer, that we would see more warming in the winter than in the summer, that we would see more warming at night than during the day, and that we would have more rainfall. And more of that rainfall would come in the early season, that is, the spring and early summer. All of those, 25 years ago, that were predicted, all of those are now being realized. We have good data to show that all of these are happening. So in the subsequent years, we've refined those models and we've used them to make more refined predictions of the kinds of conditions on average that will occur. The climate models do not predict individual events or even individual years. They can only be evaluated by looking at decadal averages and trends over long periods of time. But since that was published 25 years ago, we have a couple of decades to look at to see, are these trends actually happening? And so this gives us confidence that even the early models had it right. They had the basic core of physical reason behind climate change right, and that it's due to the increase in greenhouse gases, heat-trapping gases.
What is the most serious result of the decisions currently being made by the administration?
In my view, the biggest disappointment is that it's going to be a disruption of a trend that has been in place now in the U.S. for the last 15 years or so, 20 years, toward understanding the need to develop sustainable practices in our everyday lives, in our manufacturing, in our agriculture, in our transportation. And so we have made remarkable strides in more efficient automobiles, more efficient and cleaner power plants, in using renewable energy. We've, with our solar and wind energy build-outs of the last 10 or 15 years, we now have a larger fraction, still small, but a larger fraction of our national energy comes from these renewable sources. And hydropower is no longer the largest supplier of renewable energy. The largest supplier of renewable energy is now wind, which suggests that we are on a path toward continued increase in our use of renewable energy. Unfortunately, this lack of agreement with the Paris Accord is going to probably delay some of the activities that would be promoted through the federal government. But the upside is that the private sector is stepping in, and major corporations like Dow Chemical and General Motors and Walmart and Google and Microsoft have made commitments that they are going to purchase renewable energy when it's available, and they're willing to pay a premium for it. So this suggests that it's not politics only that's going to drive our future, but it's economics and it's the dedication to doing the right thing.
Thank you very much, Gene. This is KHOI Community Radio, and our guest has been Gene Tackley, a professor of agricultural meteorology and climatologist, who has been telling us his take on the effects of President Trump's withdrawal from the Paris Climate Accord. We'll hear from Gary Guthrie, known to many of our listeners as the founder of community-supported agriculture in central Iowa. Our other guests. Hello, Gary.
Good morning. Good morning. I think following Gene is a good segue in the sense of trying to do the right thing with some of the changes that we've been doing on our farm these last few years, with going to no-till, using cover crops, and establishing some prairie strips on our land, on our larger farm, which is only 160 acres. But I certainly have tried to climate change. What are ways that we can make our farm more resilient? I can't change all of Iowa or the world, but what can I do on this piece of property to make a small bit of difference?
Gary, this is Paul Wearson. I'm the co-host with Susan today.
Yeah.
And 160 acres, when I grew up, that was a typical family farm back in the 1950s. So that number rings true with me. I live on our family farm south of Story City. Have you always been a farmer, Gary?
No. My dad worked with the USDA and wanted a piece of this black gold that he called. He grew up in western Oklahoma during the Dust Bowl era. And I went off after college. I got my degree in agronomy at Iowa State, but I wanted to serve overseas, so I ended up going to Bolivia and then El Salvador, working with the Mennonite Central Committee, trying to work in sustainable agriculture in Bolivia and the sub-humid tropics. So I saw pretty, back in the early 80s, the whole world was talking about climate change or the rainforest. And I was there on ground level trying to work with agriculturalists to provide sustainable systems there. And lo and behold, sustainability became a hot word here in the United States when I returned in 1990.
Now, you might remind our audience what CSA means. It's not Confederate States of America, right? That used to be on the belt buckles of soldiers during the war. CSA.
You are correct. You are correct. It's not that. It's community-supported agriculture. So when we moved back to my parents' land, I just have 2 acres next to the house here that I started a vegetable operation on. So very intensely planting of vegetables, and then people sign up ahead of time for that weekly delivery of vegetables. So I have a market. I had a market for everything that I grew, and if I wanted to expand, I just expanded my acreage and added members. So I started in 1997 with 4 families, and that eventually, when I retired, the main part of my business in 2010 to have more time to care for my parents, I was servicing 75 families on 1.5 acres, or 2 acres, but 1.5 acres of production every year.
Well, it sounds like you had great word of mouth from the core group you began serving. You must have done a good job.
So I was very fortunate with the soil that I had and choosing good varieties. And, yeah, and I had was able to build up some good relationships there. And so that, yeah, that worked out pretty well.
And you're also creating some of your own energy on the farm. Tell us about that.
Yeah, about 10 years ago, we were gifted with some money, and this whole thing with carbon was kind of working on our conscience. And a friend of ours over in Melbourne, he put up a wind tower, a small wind tower. And once I saw that, and my in-laws had gifted us with a little bit of money, so my wife and I, Nancy and I, decided to invest in that, and felt very, very good about it. So that was the beginning, and we had worked at lowering our consumption in our household with the lights and a number of different things. And so we got our average consumption down to about 400 kilowatt hours a month. And the wind tower provided about 80% of that on average throughout the year. So it varies between 360 and 380 a month if you average that out over the whole year. So. And then a few years after that, then we decided when solar panel prices started coming down, we invested in 6. And a few years after that, we added another 4. So we have 10 solar panels. So now we produce, on average, between with the wind and the solar, we produce about 660 kilowatt hours a month.
Well, how does that merge with the energy company? What's your relationship with them? You're still on the grid. But
we're still on the grid.
If you produce your own energy, how does that work with the utility?
So with we're with Alliant Energy, and we were one of the first people, not the very first, but early on. It took a little bit of work to do it, but we are on net metering, so we produce excess meter energy. It goes out on the line, and it measures that, and then when we consume more than we're producing, then that meter is what comes off their line, and then we pay the difference, or they bank. If we have excess, they bank it.
So you regard Alliant as supportive of what you're doing?
Sort of.
Sort of. I just wondered how they view that.
It's kind of by law, so they're kind of required to do this. They're trying to, they don't like cogeneration, I don't think, too much, although it does generate capacity for them.
Well, I think it's very interesting. And now, how tall is your windmill?
It's 75 feet.
Now, is that supported by guy wires? Or?
Yes, it is.
So you have a structure that's supported by guy wires. It's safe. And when someone looks at the investment here, both for solar panels and for a windmill like you have, is it cost prohibitive?
No, not anymore. And I would say solar has gotten so much less expensive that it probably beats out small wind turbines as far as cost efficiency.
And so when you look at the initial investment and the number of years that would pay back or pay for itself, it looks even more feasible than it did, let's say, 5-10 years ago, right?
Yes, for sure, for sure. And what I like to look at is, instead of how fast will it pay off, I want to know what my return on investment is. So how much am I saving? So let's say I invest $10,000 in a system, and I'm saving, you know, $500 a month or whatever, or $500 a year. My return on investment is, what, 5%? So I look at what my return on investment is, and it's between 3 and 5%. So that's a lot better than having my money in the bank.
So that's very good. So, you know, Gary Guthrie here, our guest, is not only doing organic farming, and he has local clients to consume what he grows, he's also doing very intelligent things about energy usage and conservation and producing his own energy on the farm. And Gary Guthrie, I want to congratulate you for being creative, innovative, and still making money while doing so. Good job, well, Gary.
Thanks, Paul. And I wanted to make, Susan was interested too. We're investing in 9 more solar panels, even though it's not going to benefit us very much. It's going to lower my dad's electric bill. But this is our anti-Trump statement.
Okay. All right. Well, now, that's
no matter what goes on, we need to continue to make investment to lower our carbon footprint.
That's a great idea. And if Donald's listening to KHOI, this should breed a tweet sometime today. So thank you very much, Gary. Gary Guthrie. Terrific. That's just wonderful. Wow.
This is KHOI Community Radio, and we've just heard from Gary Guthrie, the Carrot King, about organic farming, truck farming, what we used to call truck farming, the community-supported agriculture, and his wind and solar experiments on his farm. And now we turn to events of this weekend. First, let's go to Bill Hook in Cambridge for a festival with a purpose.
My name is Bill Hook. I'm the fire chief for Cambridge Fire Department. It's actually called Fireman Days, and we have a 2-day event going on, and Friday night we'll have some local bands. Fire department will be grilling out, ice cream social, junior firefighter contest. So a few little things going on Friday night. Saturday, we'll have a pancake breakfast, 2-mile fun run, parade, several things going on in the park. Fire department will also put on like an extrication demonstration, how we use our jaws of life and other equipment. The fire stations will be open for people to view the trucks and kind of an open house. There'll be a concert later that night. Richard Arndt from 7 to 10, his band of Brews, so bring lawn chairs. We'll have plenty of food and drinks. All of this is to raise money to, we're expanding our fire station. It's over 40 years old and we have outgrown it. So we're in the process right now of building a three-bay addition onto the back.
Oh, that's quite an ambitious project.
Yes, it's something we've desperately needed. We've been raising money for several years, and with the help of a grant and donations from the community and fundraisers, we're able to start putting up the building.
Oh, that's pretty exciting. What happens if you have a fire over the weekend?
It has happened many times. We've had fires or car accidents or something, and my department also covers a wide range of Interstate 35, so if that happens, we usually designate several firemen that if it's a medical call, you're going to respond. If it's a fire call, this group's going to respond. So we still have a good turnout, and then we also have good mutual aid with our neighboring communities.
Well, who are the communities that you serve besides Cambridge?
We serve Cambridge and Union Township. And then, of course, we also, within Union Township, is Interstate 35, so we cover quite a variety there. And we have surrounding towns, Huxley, Maxwell, Kelly, Nevada, sometimes Elkhart, that if they're needing assistance, we will also take our trucks and help those departments out also.
You're not only fire, but first responders, is that right?
Yes, that's correct.
And how do your first responders get their training?
We send all of our first responders either to an EMT or first responder class. So they'll actually go to DMAC, or if any other schools in the area that have the training, we'll send them there. And all firefighters on Cambridge, they're required to take Firefighter 1 class so they can be certified in Firefighter 1 also. So we have probably about half of our members are trained EMT or first responder also.
This sounds like a very important purpose for your festival, and we wish you well.
Well, thank you. Yeah, we're looking forward to it. It's last few years have been a really good time, and we're hoping this year will be the same.
Thank you, Bill.
Yep, thank you.
Bye. And now for a preview of Ankeny Community Theater's production of In the Middle of Yesterday with director Cheryl Clark.
This is Cheryl Clark. I am the director of The Middle of Yesterday at Ankeny Community Theater. This play is written by Ken Jones and published by Hewer Publishing. The play is about an 84-year-old Navy veteran who is suffering from Alzheimer's, and he's in a care facility. And during the play, he interacts with his son, who's obviously a grown man, and the nurse. But we also see him interact in his memory with his wife and his daughter and his son when he was younger. So there's kind of two plays going on at once. The reality that's occurring in the care facility and the memories that we're seeing in Kilby's mind.
How many characters are there then?
There are seven characters in the play. Kilby, who has the 84-year-old man with Alzheimer's, and his nurse, and then his grown son, Stephen. And the players in his memory are his wife, Leanna, and his daughter, Lily, and his son as a younger person, so it's Stephen, but as a 17-year-old. And then we also see a soldier who represents Kilby, the old man, in his younger days.
And is his wife living at the time that he's 84?
No. The only one of his family left alive is his son, Stephen. His daughter has also died. And so the memories help us as an audience understand what's happened to his family and also some issues that he is still dealing with as an old man, some conflict he's had with his son over the years. So the story, although it's about Alzheimer's, also is a lot about family relationships and how we can support one another and the support that's needed for people who give care to others, and about forgiving and loving as well.
Have you directed before for Ankeny Community Theater?
Yes. I've directed, a year ago, I directed a children's show called A Tree with Arms. And there were 11 youngsters in it, ages 8 to 11. And so this one has one teenage girl in it, but otherwise it's adults. And then last fall, and also for the State Festival, I directed a play called 110 Stories. So those are the directing roles I've had at Ankeny Community Theater.
Well, I would imagine that this play has quite a different audience than the others.
It does. I think that people come to it, many people come to it with some experience or some relationship to Alzheimer's. We know that 1 in 9 people 65 and over in the country at this point in time suffer from Alzheimer's, and 1 in 3 people 85 and older suffer from Alzheimer's. So it's a very prevalent disease, and many people have experienced it as caregivers, either as children of parents who suffered from Alzheimer's, or a lot of people who have come to see our show are actually grandchildren whose grandparents suffered from Alzheimer's. And myself, my father died from complications of Alzheimer's a year ago, and so lots of experience with dealing with Alzheimer's and just how devastating that can be to a person's mind.
Let's get those dates. That is the 9th, 10th, and 11th of June, and the 16th, 17th, and 18th of June. And at what time?
On Friday and Saturdays, the shows are at 7:30 in the evening, and on Sundays, it's at 2 p.m.
And where is the Ankeny Community Theater?
Our address is 1932 3rd Street Southwest.
Two more successful weekends, and it's been great to talk to you. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. That was Cheryl Clark. Goodbye. You've been listening to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio. I, Susan Franzen, have been your host for today, together with my co-host, Paul Wearson. Other voices you heard were Tom Franzen, Eugene Tockley, Gary Guthrie, Bill Hook, and Cheryl Clark. Local Talk airs at 7 a.m., noon, and 7 p.m. here on KHOI at 89.1 FM. Also, remember that you can hear it online at khoifm.org and find links to the guests and information you heard during the program. KHOI is streaming live online at khoifm.org.
And our theme song, as always, is Backtrackin' by Tom Richards and Al Harris. That's from their CD, The Ballad of Kate Shelley. Local Talk is a radio production workshop as well as a show, so if you would like to try your hand at reporting, we'll train you. Come in and join the Local Talk team. We've made a change at our morning schedule, and until now, Democracy Now! Was aired on KHOI at 6 p.m. weekday evenings. Now we are airing it at 8 to 9 a.m., and Morning Masterpieces will return at 9 a.m. We have made this change in light of the rapidly changing events in the national news, and we want to provide you with the latest news in the most timely fashion possible. So let us know what you think. You can call us at 515-292-2878, email us at khoiradio@gmail.com, or go to our website at khoifm.org.
So stay tuned for Democracy Now! With headline news at the top of the hour. And you can still hear it at 6 p.m. Remember, you, the listener, are what makes KHOI meaningful and possible. Thank you for listening, and
we'll see you again on the radio.
Support for KHOI comes from Mary Greeley Medical Center, providing inpatient and outpatient services on a continuum of care, located at 1111 Duff Avenue in Ames. Find out more information at www.mgmc.org. That's mgmc.org.